All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm happy to welcome Ahmed Alassi back to the show. He's an Egyptian-American living in Cairo, part of the revolution movement over there. And now I find out he is the coalition coordinator of the Egyptian International Coalition for Lifting the Siege and Rebuilding Gaza. Welcome back to the show, Ahmed. How are you doing?
Good. How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing great. I didn't realize you had such a great title to say out loud like that. All right, good deal. Well, so listen, I want to hear all about the Gaza Strip. We can spend at least the entire last segment on that if you want to talk about all those politics. But right now, I want to know about the arrest of Hosni Mubarak and the abolition of his political party, such as it was, and all of these things. Is this true? What does it mean? Is he going to jail? What's going to happen? What about his sons?
These are great questions. Okay, let me start off with his arrest. And basically, the Attorney General issued a an arrest warrant for both Hosni Mubarak and his family, and specifically his two sons, Gamal and Ala Mubarak. And apparently, during questioning, Mubarak was apparently had a heart condition, and they didn't go into any further details and was admitted into the hospital. And he's currently in a hospital in Sharm el-Sheikh. And, of course, that only came after the Friday before last, roughly about 2 weeks ago. The people were quite restless. There were major protests in Tahrir Square, and they basically had a people's trial of Mubarak, which they were basically accusing him of, not accusing, but I mean, basically having a public trial without him there, a mock trial, if you will. And afterwards, you know, they basically threatened to stay there for a while, just like before he was released, and they were saying that all that's happening is, you know, it's being too slow. And this came after, I believe, also Hosni Mubarak released on Al Arabiya News Network, which is a Saudi-owned television station, and that Mubarak released an audio tape right after that, after people protested in Tahrir, and he was saying that he's completely innocent and he's never done anything wrong and that he will sue people who actually accuse him of that. And of course, that was just like, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back. So he was taken in for questioning, which is technically he was issued, the arrest warrant was for 15 days of imprisonment until they question him. And this is for, like, money laundering and other illegitimate monetary gains that he
had.
Well,
now, I read that a judge had said, I'm not certain if the judge had ruled, but he had said that Mubarak was responsible for the protesters who were shot by the security services back then. Do you think that there's actually going to be a real trial, a real prison term for Hosni Mubarak here, that he is actually facing justice?
Well, this is what I was going to get to. There are two different things going on in conjunction to one another here. And according to Egyptian law, the Attorney General has the right to imprison people for up to 15 days terms, up to 60, renewable to up to 60 days. So that he can question them before trial. And currently, they're still within the first 15 days, and both his sons are being questioned. In addition to that, there's a fact-finding committee around the incident, the so-called camel incident that happened in Tahrir Square, and the snipers that were basically taking people out, protesters, in the middle of Tahrir Square. And this fact-finding committee has been deliberating for the past 2 months. And they have concluded, I believe yesterday, that Mubarak was definitely responsible. This is after questioning you know, all kinds of people, including the ex-head of intelligence, Omar Suleiman, who was also the ex-VP of Mubarak. And they questioned him, and of course, he denied all charges against Mubarak, but the fact-finding committee did conclude in the end that Mubarak was responsible. So this should be used in his civil lawsuit or an criminal lawsuit that will be directed towards him. But he is currently, by the way, not under arrest. He is in the hospital in Sharm el-Sheikh. And what was, I think that the thing that really got the army to move and the attorney general was that a lot of people were saying, if he doesn't get arrested, we're going to get 1,800 buses, fill them up with people, and head over, you know, take the show on the road, if you will, and go bring him to justice. And I think after that was declared, they arrested him. And he's currently, you know, it's a very strange sort of thing where, you know, technically he's under arrest, but he is in the hospital, so he's limited. We don't have that much more information. So is it possible that he might be held responsible for all this stuff? I think it's very probable. A lot of people feel that it is, a necessity to hold him responsible and everyone else that was responsible for the death. In addition to that, a very big thing is that, you know, there's an estimated $70 billion U.S. dollars that he has, as his personal, and the Mubarak family as their own personal money, which obviously that's like ill-gained money that belongs to the Egyptian people. And I believe the Attorney General had requested for a lot more of the banks, international banks, to sort of freeze his accounts, his international accounts, and they have refused and claimed that there needs to be more evidence. His salary was like less than $40,000, I believe, annually. So, I mean, I don't see how you could, you know, make $70 billion. And that's just, by the way, the banks that would say how much they have. Including, you know, Switzerland's top two banks who refuse to actually reveal the amount that they hold over there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would expect the banks all to try to keep the money for themselves rather than, you know, give it to the Treasury of Egypt or to the Egyptian people or anything like that. But so here's the thing, though. I mean, that's more or less, I'm pretty sure that's the coolest thing I ever heard. The people said, we will go and get Mubarak and try him ourselves. And that's what forced the military to go ahead and arrest him. I mean, that's people power in action right there. You guys seem to have learned your lesson that you can do it. We'll be right back after this. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and on the line is Ahmed Alassi. He's an Egyptian-American living in Cairo, and I know, well, before we get to Gaza, I'll read that proper title I got here now about, well, here it is. He's Coalition Coordinator for the Egyptian International Coalition for Lifting the Siege and Rebuilding Gaza. And we'll talk all about that, but I wanted to let you respond basically to my point about, you know, holy moly, you guys really seem to think that you can get together by the millions and demand that the military give in to your every will, even if that means arresting the former dictator. And it seems like you're pretty hopeful that there will actually be some comeuppance for this old guy.
Yeah, I think there's a pretty good chance that, you know, he's held responsible, not just him, but the rest of his cronies are held responsible for what they have done, whether it's, you know, starting from the January 25th revolution or from before that, you know.
Because, you know, my dark imagination says, nah, the CIA's running wild all over that place, and they're going to make sure that whatever happens next is horrible.
Well, I mean, surely there are a lot of secondary plans that they have, and I think a lot of the, like, for example, Dr. Baradei, who's supposedly one of the people that are set to go in place of him, Ayman Nour and these people who are supposedly going to take over. I mean, Baradei used to work for, used to head up something called the Crisis Group, which is a George Soros organization, which, I mean, would be like no difference. It's just like a new face to the same sort of dictatorial regime. And we definitely do not want that. I think for the majority of Egyptians, they sort of see that. They see that this is another attempt at hijacking the people's uprising. And we want a democracy. We want to be able to voice our opinion. We want to be heard. And this should be this is the will of the people. And I think more and more every day, we're learning how to achieve better results faster and more powerful with less problems. And you know, thank God that the army is, for the most part, receptive to the will of the people and implementing what the people want. They're a little bit slow, but they're coming around. And I think a great deal of why they're actually doing exactly what we're asking is because we're in a non-passive way, we're requesting real change, genuine change, and not superficial change. And that, like you said, the NDP party, which is the National Democratic Party of Hosni Mubarak, was just sort of, they tried to give it several facelifts, and in the end it just did not work. People were like, this has to go. And all of their headquarters, because they had headquarters in every small government or, you know, state and city, and that was like, you know, state-owned property that they used to, you know, quote unquote rent for like, you know, pennies every month, and it was misuse of public money, and that's like, you know, putting it politely. So all of those, everything that, you know, the party's been disbanded and everything has been confiscated and sort of taken back by the government, because for the most part these were publicly owned buildings that belonged to the people at one point, and they're just regaining that back. And the cousin of the late President Anwar Sadat, his name is Talat, sorry, not the cousin, the nephew of the late President Anwar Sadat, had tried to basically, you know, refurbish the party and take it over again. He had some popularity.
Really?
And basically he was very upset with the judge's decision to disband it. And he vowed to sort of bring it back under a new name and call it the New Democratic Party, which is...
But you're saying that did not go off, though. The people saw right through that, and it really has been abolished now?
Yes, it has. But he vowed to create a new party, and basically and this is like, I think, almost a direct quote. He said that he would get the best, the quote-unquote best, of the old NDP. And we all know that every single one of these people were corrupt, you know?
Well, let's hope that the masses there can maintain their confidence and their ability to continue to say no to this kind of thing. I think what's happened there so far has just been absolutely remarkable, and I got to give you a chance to talk about your meeting with the new foreign minister, who I believe you told me before on the show that he was a former transportation minister guy, something like that, and after two or three tries of putting different people in there, the masses in Tahrir Square said absolutely not two or three times in a row until you guys got this guy. You said he seemed like he might be promising, and now you've had a meeting with him as a coordinator of this Egyptian International Coalition for lifting the siege and rebuilding Gaza. So tell me all about that and how hopeful you are about the future of Egyptian relations with the Gaza Strip.
Well, first, I would just like to make a slight correction. It's the person that you're referring to that was the former transportation minister is the prime minister, the current prime minister, Assam Sharaf.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Dr. Nabil Al-Arabi, that's okay. Dr. Nabil Al-Arabi, who is the current Egyptian foreign minister, used to actually be a former UN delegate. Of Egypt. And,
I see. You told me about the two of them at the same time, and I got their stories
mixed up.
Go ahead.
From all of Dr. Nabil Al-Arabi's, he was saying this stuff. He was quite vocal about his stance on the Gaza blockade, and he was in an article published on the 19th of February, he basically said the same things we've been saying for a long time, and that is that it is an inhumane, unjust blockade that needs to end as soon as possible. And the article was titled, "It is Time for a Major Change in Egypt's Foreign Policy." And in the article, he basically outlined the fact that, you know, if Egypt, specifically the SCAF, which is the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, who currently rules Egypt, in their second declaration, they basically said that they are going to keep all of Egypt's agreements with all of the regional and international agreements that they have entered. And in line with that spirit, we should also honor international agreements and laws for human rights. And even in times of war, you cannot close your borders to humanitarian aid. And that is basically what he said in his article. So based upon that, we felt that he was approachable, and we approached him. We asked him for permission to let in some goods into the Rafah border crossing, and we just got to meet with him on Sunday, where he actually gave us what was deemed as a political permission from him. Like, he approved it, and he said that he's willing to let in important aid into Gaza. And at the same time, he told us that basically things are changing, and they are currently working on opening up the Rafah border, which is a shared border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. And it is the only border that is directly open to the Gaza Strip and Egypt. You have two other border crossings, and that's Aouja and Karam Abu Salem. And these two are basically manned by Egypt and the PA and Israel. And basically, the whole point is that all humanitarian aid used to actually funnel through these two other border crossings. And from what we hear from a lot of the people inside is that it never really made it to Gaza. It would go to the West Bank, or it would be stolen, a lot of it. So a very limited amount of the aid that would actually make it into the border would actually make it into Gaza. And our request was to have the border open directly from Gaza to Egypt. And that is, basically, the former foreign minister used to use excuses such as the 2005 border agreement, which was actually, Egypt is not even a signatory on that agreement. And it was just a very lame excuse to have been using. And what needs to be done now is, like, new agreements. So within the past, the past month, Dr. Arabi's been meeting with various Palestinian factions and trying to have reconciliation talks between Fatah and Hamas, as well as, I believe, working towards opening up the border permanently, because right now it is opened up on a temporary basis. A few key points I wanted to just emphasize is that in the 2005 agreement, it was between the EU, Israel, and the PA, Palestinian Authority, and Egypt was not a signatory to that. So basically, Egypt is not bound to anything that is in that agreement. However, though, there was a previous border agreement between the PA and Egypt that basically stipulated that it would be a personnel crossing only, rather than to be used for goods and people. And what we're trying to do is to have it be for goods and personnel, specifically commercial trade, because I think it's very important that Egypt would open up with direct commercial trade with Gaza, because it would aid in the rebuilding of Gaza, and at the same time it would be good for Egyptian economy. And currently there is $5.2 billion that are awaiting for rebuilding Gaza. Some of that is U.S. aid money. Some of that has been pledged by various governments around the world for rebuilding Gaza. And the situation over there is quite dire. I mean, you have well over, tens of thousands of families that are living in tents for the past 2 years. You have 5,000 residential units that were completely destroyed, and over 50,000 residential units that were partially destroyed, some of which we saw personally. I mean, imagine, a family of, two or three families even, of 5 to 6 each, that are living in an apartment that was meant for really just, one family of four, and with no walls. I mean, that's basically the situation. So it's quite desperate. They really do need building materials over there, specifically cement and steel, which they are, according to the, blockade, are forbidden items. And I think that it is essential for us to push for getting these, essential goods to rebuild Gaza, which currently those $5.2 billion are being not being utilized. They're frozen, and they say you cannot use them, for cement that's going through the tunnels, which, by the way, costs up to 3 times as much as cement would cost to purchase normally. And in addition to that, there is it's quite sad that the only two factories that have been built in the Sinai are to serve the criminality of the state of Israel, which is to build the wall, the cement factory to build the wall, the apartheid wall. And the second is the gas company that pumps gas into occupied territories, which is actually resold back to Gazans and to people in the West Bank at outrageous amounts of money. And it's like, it's unfathomable. And by the way, these are some of the things that a lot of people are also requesting. They're saying, that gas has been sold to Israel for a fraction of the cost, the international cost. And at the same time, it's been actually at less than cost for us, you know, as Egyptians. It's like it costs more to get the gas out than and to have the infrastructure and what have you than it does than what you're getting paid for it. So it's insane. So basically, Dr. Schatz, who is the prime minister, is also currently looking at the gas agreement, and you know, with the possibility of renegotiating the price. A lot of people are asking for it to be completely cut off, or at least, you know, be given to directly to Palestine, as opposed to having it go through the middleman and have the price jacked up. So what we're hoping to do within the next couple of days is enter Gaza with also not, you know, a huge convoy, but, you know, a convoy that will sort of test the waters. And based on the approval that we got from Dr. Arabi, which, by the way, I will give you a press release on as soon as we actually get in with the stuff.
Great. Well, so let me ask you this. How central is a change in Egyptian policy toward Gaza and the opening up of that border to the revolution movement in general? I mean, I know there's a lot of different factions that help to overthrow Mubarak, don't necessarily see eye to eye on everything, but seems hard to imagine that really anybody in Egypt is for this. It seems like a pretty good litmus test for how much power and influence the people really do have over the government now, post-Mubarak.
I think that, you know, the vast majority of every single Egyptian that I've spoken to, at least, is definitely against this illegal blockade and would like to see it gone today or even yesterday. And that is, like, you know, regardless of their, you know, political stance or their religious, because, I mean, you do have, like, a lot of different types of people, you know, Palestinian people. Gaza used to be a part of Egypt. You know, you have a lot of families that are basically split right down the middle. You know, some of them are in Gaza, some of them are in Sinai. So you have, it's like your family. It's like you're basically, you know, blockading your own family. So, I mean, it's ridiculous that we've gone like this for that long. And there have been numerous convoys that have attempted to break the siege from Egypt before, but they would usually be stopped at a very early point, usually with some, like, ridiculous, you know, excuse, like you don't have a permit or something like that. So I think it is, to answer your question, one of the major, I mean, these were some of the issues that we were discussing in Tahrir before the 11th of February, where Hossein Mubarak stepped down. And I think the vast majority of people were like, you know, if he steps down today, we'll go to Gaza tomorrow. So that is, I think, the general sentiment. There might be a few people that say, maybe now is not the time. Maybe we should focus on rebuilding Egypt first. But the thing is, though, I mean, I see that it is a very essential thing for every Egyptian to want this. Because, I mean, it's good for our economy, and if it's rebuilding that you want to focus on, then you can, like, you know, open up the border, help them rebuild their side, and at the same time, you're gonna be working your factories. They want to be self-sufficient. They don't want to be relying on handouts over there. And when I went last time on the 6th, we spoke with a lot of civil society people, just average people. We're not talking government. We're not talking about, you know, any certain political, you know, normal everyday people, and they were all really, you know, sick and tired of of the blockade, and they want to be free. And they want to be self-sufficient. They don't want to rely on these aid convoys. And they want to be able to have their factories again. You know, 95% of Gaza's factories were destroyed or not functioning because of the cast-led attack and the subsequent blockade. So it's like, you know, they have no means of actually doing their stuff. And if we open up that border, you know, they're going to want textiles, they're going to want steel, cement, all of these things are, you know, the core Egyptian industry is steel and cement and textiles, to the point where, I mean, the textile industry here in Egypt is suffering from a lot of the Chinese imports that are coming in, flooding the market, and they feel that they can't compete. Well, here is a perfect opportunity for you to distribute your, you know, your production to, you know, people that are in need of it, who can, like, make their own stuff and possibly, you know, just be self-sufficient first and maybe even be able to sell. And then you can actually make money off of customs as well, as far as Egypt is concerned. So it is a very important key issue for both of us, where it's like a win-win situation if you open up the borders. Right now, it's like even residents of the Sinai Peninsula feel that they are sort of not getting their, you know, fair treatment like the majority of Egyptians living in around the Delta, which is around the Nile. And the reason for that is because there hasn't been any sort of change in infrastructure or new factories or new job opportunities. And that has been because of this, like, you know, this policy that the previous administration has had, which is criminal. And in protection of this criminality of the State of Israel for you know, blockading the Gaza Strip, they were basically doing the same, almost the same thing to the people of the Sinai Peninsula. Is that, like I said, the only two factories that were opened over there were to serve, you know, more of that criminal activity. So people over there also don't like this anymore. You know, they feel that they've gotten a raw deal. And, you know, things have gotten quite violent over there during the uprising. And I hear even up until right now, there's still, like, you know, last time when we were there, it was still pretty, you know, crazy. Like, police officers are scared to wear their uniforms over there, and they haven't been redeployed, and it's just army. And there's a good reason for that, because they were mistreating the people of the Sinai, you know, picking them up and putting them in jails for...
Yeah, and now it's not so certain that reinforcements are coming if they get into trouble. So now they're the ones
right.
on the run, huh? That's good to hear.
Right.
Even
at
the lower level, the police are scared of the people, too. Listen, I'm sorry. We're all out of time here, and we're way over time.
Yeah,
and
no
I got to cut this
off. Hey, thanks
off,
for the opportunity.
Well, I really appreciate your time that you spend on the show all the time. It's always very good stuff. I learn a lot, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
All right, everybody. That's Ahmed Alassi. He is an activist over there in Egypt. He is the coordinator of the Egyptian International Coalition for Lifting the Siege and Rebuilding Gaza.